You are listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies and the Ellison Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/Ellison Center.
So good evening. My name is Elena Campbell. I'm interim director of the Ellison Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies. So welcome to the 2023 Northwest Regional Conference for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies at the University of Washington. This year, we have a record number of participants coming from Washington, California, Oregon, Indiana, Texas, New Mexico, Idaho, Florida, North Carolina, New York City, as well as Canada, Israel, and Lithuania. Yeah. So our keynote speaker today is Alexei Yurchak, who is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of the award-winning book, Everything Was Forever Until It Was No More, The Last Soviet Generation. He's currently completing his next book, which explores the political, scientific, and aesthetic histories of Lenin's body that has been maintained by a unique research institute for a century. During the Soviet period, Lenin's body, which is still displayed in Lenin's mausoleum on the Red Square in Moscow, functioned as a central political symbol of the communist system. Well, I personally saw this body only once when I was very young. Probably, I don't know, maybe 5 years old or something. So the only thing I remember only two things, a long, long line waiting to enter. And I remember my fear, because when I entered, I was so afraid of seeing a dead body, so I kind of closed my eyes. So although Seattle is far away from the body of Lenin, on display, which is on display in the Red Square, Seattle does have its own bronze body of Lenin on display in the Fremont neighborhood, thus linking our city to the Bolshevik leader and and perhaps even more so, de-Leninization process, if I pronounce it correctly, in Eastern Europe in the early 1990s. So our guests, you're welcome to visit Fremont neighborhood, perhaps tomorrow on Saturday. Very easy. It's only 20 minutes away by bus, I think, number 31 that you can... 44? I thought 31. Okay. Well, you can take a bus from the U District and go to Fremont to check the bronze body of Lenin. But today, Alexei Yurchak will share with us the results of his research for his forthcoming book. So it is a very unique situation because we will learn about the forthcoming book before it becomes available to the broader audience. And his talk is titled Mutations of Lenin, the Sacred Core of Sovereignty, Soviet, Post-Soviet, Anti-Soviet. So please welcome Professor Alexei Yurchak.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I must say that I'm an anthropologist. This paper is connected to one chapter in the book, which Elena just mentioned, and it's the least ethnographic, the least anthropological chapter, because the others actually talk about the body and the science and the connection between ideology and the science and many other things. And not only about the Soviet Union, but about all sorts of bodies around the world. But this one talks about the image. And it's important for me to talk about the image because, as you will see, I connect it to the concept of the sacred, and the sacred understood in broad terms, not necessarily religious at all. In fact, non-religious. And so I will present you this for the first time. Okay. Visual representations of Lenin were ubiquitous in the Soviet Union. There were literally millions of them. But in the 1920s and 30s, the more images of Lenin were produced, the more it became obvious that none of these images was successful in representing Lenin. Writer Fyodor Gladkov wrote in a newspaper that his school-age son, upon hearing of Lenin's death, started drawing Lenin's portraits in 1924. The boy drew one, then another, then the third portrait, but each time he wasn't satisfied. When Gladkov asked his son why he needed to draw so many portraits, the boy replied that Lenin had to be drawn properly, but that so far he failed to achieve that. Writing about this conversation, Gladkov explained to his readers that his son was unable to draw Lenin not because he lacked artistic skills, but because art was simply incapable of capturing Lenin. "Lenin is inaccessible to us," he wrote. "He can never be depicted on paper." The claim that Lenin couldn't be represented in images and words became a recurrent theme in those years. When Lenin died and the period of public mourning began, many people were struck by the apparent doubling of Lenin's body in official rituals and speeches, into Lenin the mortal person and Lenin the immortal figure that was bigger than that person and different from it. Speaking at Lenin's funeral, Lunacharsky, at that time the Commissar of Culture and Education, said, "What are we witnessing today is not death, and what we have performed today is not a funeral. This is an apotheosis, the transformation of a living person, whose hand we could shake just recently, into a being of a higher order," unquote. Commissar of Health Nikolai Simashka explained that the task of studying Lenin had to be divided into two parts. First, one needed to study Lenin as a concrete revolutionary leader, which was a straightforward task because Lenin left behind, quote, "left behind an enormous literary heritage where his views are chiseled with a kind of clarity that leaves nothing to be desired," unquote. But there was also a need to study the second Lenin that was bigger than the person and that will continue to live among the future generations. Sculptor Ivan Shudder elaborated on this point. "Lenin's obraz," he wrote, I will explain what obraz is, he wrote, "was not just a portrait of a person, rather it was a synthesis of Leninism and Lenin Ilyich, Lenin the person, a combination of the mortal person and immortal truth. Capturing this synthesis in artistic images," Shudder lamented, "was notoriously difficult, and most artists failed to do so." Having attended a close exhibition of Lenin's images by famous artists and sculptors in spring 1924, Leonid Krasin wrote, "There is not a single bust or bas-relief on account of which one could say, yes, this is precisely how Vladimir Ilyich was," unquote. Lenin's true obraz, quote, "contained to elude artists." Newspaper Pravda elaborated in 1926, "When it comes to Lenin's posthumous portraits, artists clearly fail. The problem seemed to lay beyond artistic skills. After many attempts to create Lenin's obraz, sculptor Isaac Mendelevich admitted with resignation that the task was simply unrealizable. All that could be achieved today," he wrote, "was to assemble an archive of physical traits, a realistic document. Only in some distant future, artists may be able to, quote, use these images and documents to create symbols adequate enough to grasp Lenin's obraz. But even that was not certain." Writers and poets faced the same problem. At the celebrations of Lenin's 50th birthday, proletarian poet Kirillov said, "I must disappoint you. I will not be reading poetry about Lenin because I do not have the colors or the tools to paint this greatest figure of our time." Another proletarian poet, Nikolai Politaev, in fact did read a poem at the meeting. But instead of trying to grasp Lenin's image, his poem focused on the inability of the arts to do so. He wrote, "There simply are no Lenin's portraits. On everyone he looks diminished. One hopes that centuries to come will finish what remains unfinished. The pen, the cutter, and the brush are trying to depict in vain the world pulsating in this blood, the thought exploding in this brain." Even 15 years after Lenin's death, the task of grasping his image didn't become any easier. In the late 1930s, a literary critic summarized the enormous output of the poetic literature about Lenin that was amassed during these 15 years by writing, quote, "We must admit that not one of our poets has been able to give us Lenin's obraz in its full multidimensionality." Another critic wrote about the Soviet prose, "There is not yet in our literature a multifaceted and profound depiction of Lenin's obraz. and the theater critic, wrote about performing arts, quote, "It is one thing to conduct a superficially factual study of Lenin's obras," meaning his image, "as most actors do on stage, and quite another to penetrate it, sight it, and grasp with artistic means not just Lenin's appearance, but his very essence." All these comments repeated in different ways the idea about Lenin's doubling. Drawing a portrait of Lenin person was easy, but representing Lenin's obras, that is, representing Lenin as a synthesis of the mortal and immortal figures, was much harder, if not impossible. What does this inability to represent Lenin's obras, again, this word, tell us about the place that the figure of Lenin occupied in the Soviet polity? To investigate this question, I will start with exploring the meaning of the term obras. Obras is often rendered in English as image, but in fact it is a much broader category. Image is closer to the Russian word изображение, which refers to the representation of an object in external visual or verbal signs. Obras, on the other hand, refers not only to the representation of an object, but also to its material presence in the image. It is in this sense that obras came to be used as a synonym for the icon in Russian Orthodox Christianity. The ubiquitous claim in the 1920s and 30s that Lenin's obras could not be represented suggests that Lenin came to be experienced at the time as a figure that was sacred. These comments pointed to a set of culturally shaped sensibilities about what representing the sacred might amount to. According to this tradition, the sacred cannot be represented in external signs alone. It must be experienced as materially present in the image. This understanding of the sacred and its representation affected how Lenin's visual images were produced, evaluated, and experienced in the early Soviet period. But before I turn to the discussing the production of these visuals of Lenin, I want to explain what I mean by saying that the figure of Lenin came to be experienced as sacred. And that's important for me. I want to start with a disclaimer. I do not want to repeat a common argument that Lenin in the Soviet context functioned as a substitute for the saints of the Christian Orthodox faith. Nor do I want to say that Lenin's images functioned as substitutes for religious icons. Nor that Lenin's body was analogous to religious relics. In fact, I want to argue against all these claims. What position did the figure of Lenin occupy in the Soviet system? Lenin was seen as the source of the unquestionable and foundational truth of the Soviet project. It was in this sense that the figure was sacred. It was sacred in relation to the Soviet political world, to the Soviet polity, not unlike the founding fathers. This sacredness should not be reduced to religious terms, or at least to what is popularly understood by religion. The sacred in general is a broad category that far exceeds that which is commonly understood as religion. The breadth of this category is reflected, for example, in the existence in Russian of two terms that marks sacredness. I apologize for the non-Russian speakers, but one of them is svitoy, and the other is svishenny. They have the same root, but they mark different types of sacredness. Svitoy tends to mark an ontological quality, when something is sacred in its nature or essence. Svishenny tends to mark a relation, when something is sacred in relation to something else. In religious discourse, this distinction is reflected, for example, in the difference between relics, Russian moshe, that are usually called svitye, and reliquia, that are usually called svishennye. Relics are svitye because they are sacred ontologically, as the saint's body or its parts. Reliquia are sacred relationally, as objects that are associated with the saint externally, artifacts that the saint might have touched, wore, possessed, and so forth. In the secular usage, the person who is selfless, generous, big-hearted can be called svitoy. Anna Svitoy Chladek, she is a wonderful person, wonderful ontologically in her character. On the other hand, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man from 1789 claims that the right to property is sacred, which is rendered in Russian by the term svishenny, because this sacredness concerns the inalienable relation between the person and his or her possessions. The national borders of the Soviet Union were routinely called svishennye, but not svitye. as in the Soviet idiom, «священные рубежи Родины», «sacred frontiers of the motherland», which stress this sacredness of the border in relation to the sovereign space and its citizens. Lenin's sacredness was also overwhelmingly expressed in relational terms, as «священные», and not «святое». Examples of widely used idioms in the Soviet discourse included «священные заветы Ленина», Lenin's sacred directives. I think I probably have, no. Lenin's sacred path, Lenin's name is sacred, имя Ленина священное, and so forth. The focus of that term was not on the ontological nature of Lenin person, but on the position that figure occupied in relation to the Soviet political world. In Soviet political language, it would sound awkward or simply wrong to call Lenin святой. Even if this usage could be found in early years, it was extremely rare and was used outside of the political sphere. We encounter relational sacredness in everyday secular contexts. For example, photographs of our loved ones often share this quality. We experience it in the ability of these objects to invoke strong intersubjective feelings in us, associated with their role in the constitution of our personhood. For this reason, it is often difficult to violate such images. As W.J.T. Mitchell puts it, quote, "Everyone knows that a photograph of their mother is not alive, but they will be still reluctant to deface or destroy it. No modern rational secular person thinks that pictures are to be treated like persons, but we always seem to be willing to make exceptions for special cases," unquote. The relational sacredness of Lenin that was marked by the term «священный» was reflected in the position of this figure that this figure occupied in relation to the Soviet polity, as the figure that stood in the place of that polity's foundational and questionable truth, as I said. To put it differently, the figure of Lenin occupied the sovereign center of the Soviet political project, something to which you have to constantly refer and which you cannot question in the political language. As soon as you question Lenin, that's the implosion of the system, which happened in 1990 in the Soviet Union. So the unquestionable. How did the relational sacredness of this figure affect visual representations of Lenin in the post-revolutionary Russian world? In the Russian context, visual representations of the sacred have been shaped for many centuries by a particular semiotic model that goes back to the early Byzantine Christianity. So it was shaped in the religious context, but it was then applied in the secular one. According to that model, images of the sacred are not only its visual representations, but also sites of its material presence. That model of the image was different from the model that dominated the Latin Christian West, where images of the sacred were understood as external imitations of the sacred object. The difference between these two models of the image went deeper than theological disagreements between two branches of Christianity. It was in fact rooted in two different theories of human visual perception that originated in pre-Christian antiquity. In the Greek Byzantine world, the dominant model of visual perception was extramission. According to that model, our eyes see by sending out rays of light that touch the surface of an object. The eye in this model functions like an active and exploring hand, and sight and touch are inseparably linked into one combined sense known as tactile visuality. In the context where Western Christianity developed, the dominant model of visual perception was intromission, according to which the eye sees by receiving rays of light that are reflected from objects, instead of actively sending rays out. The eye is treated in this model as a passive receiver, and sight is understood as an autonomous and disembodied sense known as ocular visuality. In modern times, the theory of extramission, by sending rays out, right, was abandoned as unscientific. Intromission seemed to have won the debate. But in recent times, the strong distinction between these two models of vision has been problematized. We know now that our eyes do not send out rays, but we also recognize that vision involves an active and embodied act of looking, in which other senses, including tactility, are closely intertwined with sight. As Yuhani Palasma writes, quote, "All sensory experiences, including vision, can be seen as modes of touching," unquote. The centrality of tactile visuality in Eastern Christianity encouraged a person to understand an image of the sacred figure not as an external representation and not as a painting created by the brush strokes of an artist, but as a physical imprint that the sacred figure itself left on the material surface of the icon. The artist from this perspective was understood as a mediator, not creator of the image. When an icon maker in Eastern Christian context drew an image of the sacred figure, he didn't create, it was always a he didn't create that image, but offered himself as a channel through which the sacred figure sort of imprinted itself on the surface of the icon. As a result, the icon in Eastern Christianity came to be treated as an interactive medium, a kind of membrane that the sacred figure physically touches from the other side, as it were. The believer, positioned in front of the icon, could come into contact and mediation with that figure. In Orthodox churches today, as you, I'm sure, know, icons are not only looked at, but experienced physically. Believers come close to the icon, talk to it, kiss it, touch it, and so forth. This model of visualizing the sacred has been shaped in the Greek, Byzantine, and later Russian Orthodox context for a millennium. Today, this model continues to influence the relationship between the sacred and its visual representation in various contexts, including contexts that have little to do with what is popularly understood as religion. This model also affected how images of Lenin as a relationally sacred figure were produced and experienced in the early Soviet period. The constant claims at the time that Lenin's obras could not be represented in external visual science and that artists failed to capture that obras using traditional artistic means reflected this model of representation. To be adequately captured, Lenin's obras had to be materially present in the image. To invest images of Lenin with material presence, a number of techniques emerged in the 1920s and 30s, quite spontaneously. The most important of them included the use of Lenin's death mask, a limited set of his documentary photographs for a particular type, detailed anthropometrical measurements of Lenin's body, and finally that body itself, continuously embalmed, re-embalmed, and displayed in the mausoleum. The death mask was cast by sculptor Sergei Merkurov a few hours after Lenin's death, when the body was still soft. The cast was extremely detailed, with every wrinkle and pore on the skin of Lenin's face visibly imprinted in the clay surface. Small pieces of Lenin's skin and a few hairs from his beard and mustache were also embedded in it. Merkurov called his cast an historical document of extreme importance that preserved and transmitted Lenin's physical obras to the future centuries. Death masks have been long understood as unique material objects. In Roman antiquity, 2 millennia ago, death masks of ancestors made of wax played an important social function. Displayed in the most dignified place in the house, these masks were not only mementos of one's relatives, but also documentations of one's family lineage and social status, not unlike the photographs in the modern houses. From the perspective of the dominant art theory of mimesis, the theory that is based on the model of ocular visuality, remember I was talking about tactile visuality and ocular visuality, death masks are not considered to be artistic images. Unlike a sculpted bust, for example, a death mask is criticized for its excessive resemblance to the prototype. And for that reason, it is considered to be devoid of aesthetic value. From that perspective, sculptures based on death masks have been long viewed as anthropological models, but not art. But Russian revolutionary artists who worked on Lenin's obras were encouraged to see the death mask differently. These artists were subjected to two contradictory aesthetic ideologies at once. To grasp Lenin's obras, they needed to create images that had unusual aesthetic value, were created by interpretation of an artist. At the same time, these images needed to be produced to retain tangible organic link to Lenin's physical body itself. Lenin's death mask played a key role in striking the balance between these two aesthetic ideologies. And the Committee for Eternalizing Lenin's Memory required that sculptors use Merkurov's mask in their work. Merkurov submitted his original mask, the one I showed earlier, his original mask to Lenin Institute and created plaster copies of the original cast for Lenin's family and for members of the political leadership. More plaster copies of the original cast were created by art workshops all over the country for artists to consult. There were also other techniques for producing images that would be seen as aesthetic, but that also remained organically linked to Lenin's body. One technique was the use of precise anthropological measurements and descriptions of Lenin's body. In the article on studying Lenin in spring 1924, Simashko wrote, "We have done everything possible to carry out posthumous examination of Lenin's body. Physical anthropologist Viktor Budnak conducted anatomical measurements and wrote an extremely detailed descriptions of the body, providing precise measurements and ratios of different body parts. Budnak wrote that his measurements and descriptions should be used by sculptors and embalmers in their work. Here is a short excerpt from Budnak's report. "The chest is of regular cylindrical shape of medium length with well-developed tops. The height ratio of the three levels of the body, chest, abdominal, and pelvic is 43%, 31%, 23%. The height is below average, about 164 centimeters. Body type is stocky and massive. Bodily proportions, the trunk is large, 34.6% of the height, and wide, both in shoulders, 23.3%, and so forth." It's a very detailed and very long account. When Merkurov later worked on full body sculptures, the sculptor Merkurov, full body sculptures of Lenin, he first created Lenin's naked figure from clay, closely consulting his death mask and Budnak's measurements. He dressed the figure only later for the final sculpture. Merkurov applied this method when he worked in the 1930s on his most ambitious project, the 100-meter high statue of Lenin that was planned to top the Palace of Soviets. In a letter to Kliment Voroshilov, Merkurov wrote that preparing for this statue, he had created several naked and anatomically precise figures of Lenin, including three naked figures 2 meters high each, and three naked figures 1 meter high each. Sculptor Ernst Neuizvestny, who in his youth worked as an apprentice in Merkurov's workshop, wrote that, quote, "One's imagination was struck by the figure of naked Lenin. This was a model of the statue that would stand atop the palace of Soviets. Naked Lenin, how is this possible? Like a serious professional, Merkurov studied Lenin's naked flesh, inhabiting the anatomical obras of the genius." Another technique designed to ensure the organic link between the image and the body was the photograph. Immediately after Lenin's death, his body was carefully photographed in the naked state with ordinary and stereoscopic cameras from every angle. Also, an archive of Lenin's photographs in everyday context was assembled, and artists were encouraged to paint from them. Could be used, but only a limited collection of 100 approved photos. This set was kept in Lenin's Institute and published as an album for artists to consult. Other photographs were banned and confiscated from shops and libraries. The unique relationship between the photograph and the photographed object has been theorized by numerous thinkers in the 20th century. For example, André Bazin famously compared the act of making a photograph with the process of casting a death mask. But how literal is this comparison? How was the semiotic nature of the photograph conceptualized in the Russian revolutionary context? And how is this conceptualization related to the concept of tactile visuality that I discussed earlier? In the terminology of semiotician Charles Spurs, a photograph is a complex sign that combines an icon, it's a semiotic term, and an index. An icon is a sign that refers to its object through similarity, through resemblance. An index is a sign that refers to the object through causal relationship or causal connection. For example, smoke is index of fire, or the squeaking sound of the floor in another room is an index of my presence in the house. A photograph performs both iconic and indexical reference. But nothing is a sign on its own. Something becomes a sign only when it is interpreted by someone. And how one interprets a sign is shaped by the particular cultural and historical context and tradition of scene in which the person is embedded. In the Russian context, where images of the sacred had been long apprehended according to the model of tactile visuality, photographs of the sacred came to be interpreted as an index in two distinct ways, in two distinct senses. First, as a trace of the prototype, as something that happened in the past when the picture was taken and is no more. And second, as an organic link between the photographic image and the photographed object that continues to exist here now and now in the present, as if they are still linked, just like with an icon. In an essay written in 1928, photographer Alexander Rodchenko opposed regular paintings and sculptures to instant photographic snapshots, моментальный снимок, a kind of photographs that are taken quickly without being staged, posed for, or artistically rendered. Rodchenko wrote that although thousands of paintings and sculptures of Lenin had been produced by artists of all types and talents, inspired and rewarded in all sorts of ways, and not just in the Soviet Union, but practically all over the world, no artist had succeeded in grasping Lenin's obras visually. This is not surprising, Rodchenko stressed, considering that the obras of eternal Lenin exceeds all external representations. To grasp Lenin's obras, one needed to go outside of the mimetic representation and establish an unbroken organic link between the image and the body. Only photographic snapshots were capable of establishing this link, according to Rodchenko. Rodchenko understood the snapshot through the extramission model of visual perception, the one I described earlier, extending this model to the camera. The camera in this understanding is an active agent that reaches to the object, apprehends its physical form and matter, and then inserts them into the emulsion of the film. The sensorial experience of the photograph by the viewer in this model, accordingly, is understood in terms of tactile visuality. This is why the photograph in this model is considered not simply a trace of the photographic object, as André Bazin or Susan Sontag and many others would have it, but also as a site of the object's continuous presence here and now. Celebrated film director Sergei Eisenstein also theorized the photograph in terms of tactile visuality. He described the photograph as a spectral layer that is removed from the body and embedded in the emulsion surface of the negative. Eisenstein explicitly linked this conceptualization of the photograph with the Russian tradition of seeing, of tactile visuality, which came to be reflected, according to Eisenstein, in the Russian language. For example, in the verb for taking the photo, snимать, to take off, to peel off, and in the noun for a snapshot, снимок, a taking off, a peeling off. How artists drew on the approved photographs in the early period is illustrated by the work of Isaac Brodsky, who in the 1920s and 30s painted one of the largest and most definitive collection of Leniniana, of Lenin's images. Art historian Leah Dickerman showed that Brodsky regularly inserted the same photographed figures of Lenin into different paintings, changing some elements of the context. For the series Lenin in front of the Kremlin, Brodsky used a 1918 photograph of Lenin standing in the Kremlin courtyard. In some paintings in this series, he moved Lenin's figure to the other side of the river with the Kremlin visible in the background. In other paintings, he moved Lenin's figure to the Red Square and so forth. For the portrait Lenin in front of the Smolny, Brodsky lifted Lenin's figure from a photograph taken in 1919 on the Red Square in Moscow and moved it to St. Petersburg, again creating several versions of this picture. Brodsky's one of the most famous paintings by Brodsky, Lenin in the Smolny, shows Lenin in 1917 at the revolutionary headquarters in St. Petersburg. Brodsky based this picture on the photograph taken in 1921 at the Third Congress of the Comintern in Moscow. Brodsky himself is present in this photograph. He is the artist sitting on the right drawing a sketch of Lenin. However, as Leah Dickerman observed, in the painting we see Lenin from the point of view of the camera and not of the sitting artist. Brodsky chose to rely on the photographic image rather than his artistic sketch. Like other artists, Brodsky had to balance between two different aesthetic ideologies of the image, which I mentioned earlier, the ideology of mimesis that associates aesthetic value with artistic interpretation, and the ideology based on tactile visuality, according to which images of the sacred must function as physical imprints of the body. Keeping the balance between these two ideologies of the image was not always easy, and sometimes Brodsky came under criticism from either of these positions. In 1929, members of the Association of the Artists of Revolution critiqued his works for being pleasantly colored photographs. Their critique drew on the aesthetic ideology of mimesis, which devalues sculptures and pictures based on death masks and photographs. However, if images of Lenin were not based on death masks and photographs, they came under criticism from the perspective of the aesthetic ideology of extremism. Soviet artists working on Lenin in the early period had to navigate between these two contradictory ideologies of the image. Pictures and sculptures of Lenin that relied on death masks, photographs, and anthropometric measurements circulated around the Soviet Union in endless iterations. At first glance, this process appears to be similar to what Walter Benjamin famously described as mass copying of the works of art. However, there was an important difference in how the mass reproduction of images was understood and interpreted in this case. As I argued, images of Lenin in that context functioned not simply as external imitations of the original body, but as images that were organically linked to that body. At the basis of this process was not mechanical copying that Benjamin discussed, but rather what W.J.T. Mitchell calls cloning. Images produced through copying function as mechanical duplicates of the original, as its external imitations. By contrast, images produced through cloning contain an organic connection with its reference. In the process of mechanical copying, as Benjamin argued, the aura of the original is gradually lost. Conversely, the process of cloning is designed to preserve the aura of the original in every copy, that is, to maintain the material presence of the original body in every new image. But how successful was this model of visual production in practice? And how did it evolve with time? I will now fast forward a little. During the period of de-Stalinization that followed Stalin's death in 1953, the demand for new images and statues of Lenin grew exponentially. The number of artists and sculptors involved in this work also increased. Sculptor Grigory Yastrebensky, who created many sculptures of Lenin after the late 1950s, described that shift to me as follows. Immediately after the 20th Party Congress, that is 1955, many new Lenins had to be produced. There was not a single village or town that didn't have a monument or a bust of Lenin, often a new one. They were in every school, factory, auditorium, on central squares, and so on. I managed to join that trend. Most sculptors around me did the same. We even stopped asking each other, what monument are you working on? We only asked for what place are you sculpting, because it was obvious that they were sculpting Lenin. Although many sculptors still had a copy of Lenin's death mask in their studio, now these were not good copies of the original cast, but distant copies of other copies. This is a distant copy of a copy. The new masks lacked physiognomic precision and nuance and were used merely to reproduce the general dimensions of the head and the face. Many artists stopped using Lenin death masks at all, relying instead on the busts and statues of Lenin that other sculptors around them created. In this process of copying images from other images, artists focused on reproducing bigger elements of the visual form that images shared across each other, at the expense of smaller physiognomic details of Lenin's face and head. Instead of working as precise physical imprints of the original body, images and sculptures of Lenin became increasingly depersonalized and schematized. In November 1957, a teacher of history from Moscow was struck by this shift in the stylistics of Lenin's images that he saw at an art show in the Manege Gallery. The teacher wrote in his diary that canvases and statues of Lenin were now reminiscent of the schematic images on posters. Quote, There is absolutely nothing personal, unique, original in the approach of different artists to the image of Lenin. Their rendering of Lenin's obras is essentially no different than Lenin on posters, Lenin embroidered on banners, and Lenin depicted on huge canvases hung on the streets and squares during holidays. I feel sorry for Lenin, unquote. The shift over the personal images was also visible in the statues and busts that developed after the mid-1950s. These statues were moving from realistic depictions of Lenin's figure that were interpreted as precise imprints towards a more laconic and simplified form that was detached from the precise look of the actual person. In most of these statues, Lenin's figure was becoming taller, more youthful, dynamic, and so forth. This shift was also manifested in how images of Lenin were experienced publicly. In the 60s and 70s, a new and widely shared sensibility emerged, according to which drawing Lenin's portrait was seen as a problem unless the author of the drawing had a special license to do so. In reality, no exclusive license for the production of Lenin's images existed. However, the fact that it was that its existence, the existence of the license, was widely assumed, reveals much about the transformation of Lenin's image during that period. To analyze why this popular attitude emerged and what it tells us about the image of Lenin in the late Soviet period, I will start by discussing how drawings of Lenin made by school children were experienced publicly during the earlier periods between 1920s and 1950s, and in the later period after the 1960s. So in the early period, it was common for school children to draw Lenin's portrait like any other subject. The drawings were regularly displayed in classrooms and at art shows, and parents and teachers praised children for their efforts. Recall the story with which I started my talk. Soon after Lenin's death, writer Gladkov wrote in the newspaper that his son was trying to draw Lenin. Gladkov explained to his readers that the boy had trouble capturing Lenin's obras because that obras was inaccessible to us. But he had admired his son for trying, and he wrote about it publicly. In April 1924, a boarding school in the town of Kyshtyn near Chelyabinsk organized an art competition among its students to celebrate the anniversary of Lenin's birthday. Students drew Lenin's portraits from his photographs, and the best works were displayed in the public exhibition. 10 years later, in May 1934, the first international exhibition of children's drawings in Moscow displayed many portraits of Lenin by school children ages 7 to 15 from all over the Soviet Union. This is the ones at the bottom. In 1939, youth magazine Pioneer published a picture by artist Alexei Pahomov that showed a schoolboy drawing a portrait of Lenin from a photograph in the art club of Leningrad Palace of Pioneers. In the 1950s, a 13-year-old boy from Moscow wrote in his diary about frequently drawing Lenin's portraits along with other students, along with other subjects, I'm sorry. In April 1963, a man from the town of Cheripovets wrote in his diary, quote, "When we came home, Talka immediately sat down to draw Lenin. She saw his image in the library. She showed us Lenin. Wow, such resemblance and great flowers. Talka draws from memory when she feels inspired. She must go to art school," unquote. There was clearly nothing wrong or out of the ordinary at the time about children's drawings of Lenin and about displaying these portraits to friends, teachers, parents, and at public art shows. But in the 1950s, the situation changed. The common attitude to the children's drawings of Lenin started to transform. Reading diaries and memoirs of the late Soviet period and talking to the former Soviet people who went to schools during that time, one encounters story after story in which children were told that they were not supposed to draw Lenin, that only specially designated professional artists were allowed to draw his portraits. In the late 1960s, a 10-year-old girl from Leningrad drew a portrait of Lenin for the Day of Soviet Pioneers in her school. When the teacher saw the picture, she said, quote, you should not display it at our exhibition and don't show it to anyone. Only the best artists can draw Lenin," unquote. A decade later, a school teacher in Kaliningrad told a student who drew Lenin's portrait for a celebration, quote, You should not touch Lenin. You may experiment with other portraits, but not with Lenin, unquote. Another former student described an event in her school in a Siberian town in the early 1970s. Quote, one boy in our art class copied Lenin's portrait from a textbook. When the teacher saw his drawing, she took it from the desk and said that he shouldn't show it to others. Then she explained to the whole class that we were not supposed to draw Lenin because his features could not be distorted. She added that only members of the Union of Artists were supposed to draw Lenin. Another student from a town in the middle of Russia who went to primary school in the late 70s recounts the following story. We had a wonderful subject called extracurriculum reading. You had to read a story at home, draw a picture, and retell the story in class. One day, the teacher asked us to read a story about Lenin. So I drew a picture and brought it to school. But the other students jumped on me. Micah, what have you done? What? You're not supposed to draw Lenin. Why? Only special artists can draw Lenin. I decided that they were kidding. The teacher called my name. Like a good student, I retold the story and read and showed her my drawing, fully expecting a well-deserved A. But instead, the teacher said, sit down, B. Why? Because you're not supposed to draw Lenin. So I will skip a little bit. As I mentioned, in fact, there was no regulation forbidding children and amateurs to draw Lenin. But in the popular imagination at that time, this regulation existed. Teachers felt quite anxious about children's pictures of Lenin and invariably warned them not to draw Lenin and not to show their pictures to anyone if they did draw. It seems that many adults experienced such drawings as a kind of transgression. The problem was not, or not only, in the child's lack of artistic skills, but in the subject matter itself. Even if a portrait of Lenin was drawn well, it was still experienced as a transgression. But what exactly did these drawings transgress? And why did this negative reaction to the image develop in the last two decades of Soviet history and not before? The answer to this question is related to the changing form of Lenin's image in the late 1950s, early 60s, and in its relation to the sacred. As I argued, in the earlier periods, images of Lenin were produced to be linked organically to his physical body. But this understanding of the image changed when Stalin's crimes were denounced and the campaign of de-Stalinization began. One of the main crimes of which Stalin was accused at the time was that he profoundly distorted Lenin and his ideas and the Leninist thought in general. With the denunciation of Stalin, the position of the singular authoritative interpreter of Lenin, of Lenin's ideas, plans, character, was also destroyed. It was now impossible to claim authoritatively as the final arbiter, as Stalin once did, what Lenin really meant in this or that text, and what his real practice would be in this or that situation. While Leninism was still treated as the foundational truth of the Soviet project, that truth became depersonalized. This shift was also manifested in the images of Lenin. As I argued earlier, in the late 1950s, the good copy of Lenin's original death mask lost its role in the production of statues. Instead of using good copies, the mask, artists turned to the masks that were distant copies of copies and that lacked personal nuance of Lenin's face. Many sculptors stopped using masks at all. In the absence of such techniques, new images of Lenin were produced by copying formal elements from other images. In the process of copying, visual forms between different images contributed to further depersonalizing Lenin's portrait, making it more schematic and abstracted. These new images increasingly worked not as portraits of the real person, linked to the real mortal body of Lenin, as before, but as portraits of the sovereign, of the depersonalized body as such. A paradigmatic example of this shift was the well-known image created by artist Andrei Mylnikov in 1961 for the stage curtain of the Kremlin Palace of Congresses. This is a depersonalized portrait of the sovereign par excellence. While it is still linked to Lenin's body, and it is recognizably Lenin, it is also completely devoid of the material presence of that body. Between the 1960s and 1980s, this image and its many imitations became the most dominant image of Lenin in the Soviet Union. reproduced in millions of copies on posters, badges, journal covers, and decorations for public places, it superseded all other images. It was also around that time that the attitude of adults to the children's drawings, which I just described, changed. Let me reiterate this point. Between the 1920s and 1950s, official images of Lenin were produced to be organically linked to his body. This link was guaranteed by special techniques of image production, such as the use of death masks, photographs, anthropological measurements, and so forth. Official images of Lenin produced in this way were seen as stable, predictable, and grounded in the actual personal body. In that context of image production, drawings of Lenin made by children or amateurs were not perceived as a threat to the official image. They were marginal efforts, and they were admirable, but innocent. But when the death masks and other techniques that linked the image and the body faded away, the only guarantee that the image continued to be organically linked to the body and continued to be invested with Lenin's material presence was the figure of the artist himself or herself. It was in that context that the popular assumption developed, according to which only specially designated artists were allowed to draw Lenin, artists who had exclusive access to the sacred. Many adults felt that if images of Lenin were created not by such specialized artists, the presence of the sacred in the body would be undermined. From this perspective, children's drawings of Lenin were not simply unprofessionally drawn. They were more than that. They were portraits that actively undermined the sacred and then therefore performed a kind of blasphemy. It was for that reason that these images were not supposed to be drawn. And if they were drawn, they were not supposed to be shown. In the late 1980s, perestroika began. I will again fast forward here for reasons of time. One of its main tasks, articulated by Gorbachev in 1986, was to overcome all previous distortions of Lenin and return to the real Lenin, to his original plans and designs, as a way of solving the problems of Soviet socialism. But the result of perestroika was unexpected. Instead of returning to real Lenin, the reformers ended up demonstrating that real Lenin had little to do with the constructed Leninist truth that occupied the sovereign position in relation to the project, and that enabled the implosion of the Soviet Union. However, this was not the end of Lenin's image. As the post-Soviet years and the recent events in this recent war demonstrate, the attacks on the statues of Lenin during the post-Soviet period, including the famous Lenin apart in Ukraine, were first and foremost attacks not on the real Lenin person with his real ideas, but on the figure of that sovereign, this other one. Remember the doubling. The persistent doubling of Lenin is clearly visible today in the bloody aggression of Putin's Russia against Ukraine. Putin hates the real Lenin and traces all Russian problems to Lenin. The problems as he sees them, of course. Putin attacks in particular Lenin's principle of statehood, according to which the Soviet Union was designed as a federation of nations, with each nation having a nominal right to secede from the Union. In the presidential address on February 21st, 2022, 3 days before the invasion, Putin said, quote, "Lenin's principles of statehood were not just a mistake, they were worse than a mistake, as the saying goes," unquote. Putin also claimed that Lenin placed a time bomb at the foundation of the Soviet state. It was Lenin's principle of statehood that, according to Putin, eventually undermined the Soviet Union, and today continues to undermine what Putin imagines as the Russian world. According to the same Putin's logic, Lenin is also guilty of creating an independent Ukraine, and the current war, according to Putin, is designed to fix the problem that Lenin personally brought about. But there is a strange paradox. While Putin attacks Lenin for destroying the Soviet Union and undermining the sovereign Russian world, soldiers of the invading Russian army erect statues of Lenin in the occupied territories of Ukraine. In the 14 months of the war, the Russian army has installed dozens of statues and busts of Lenin in the Ukrainian towns and villages that it occupied. I'll just go quickly. So on the left will be the original picture then, empty pedestal when during Lenin apart, it was toppled, and then the Russian army now puts it back on. So this is putting back on. So I'll stay on this image. But there is a strange paradox. While Putin attacks Lenin for destroying the Soviet Union and undermining the sovereign Russian world, soldiers of the invading Russian army erect statues of Lenin in the occupied territories of Ukraine. Putin hates Lenin and calls him the evil spirit that continues to haunt Russia. That's a quote. But Putin's army erects statues of Lenin in the territories they occupy. How can this paradox be explained? As I argued, Lenin's obverse was doubled from the beginning as a combination of the real mortal person and the imagined immortal sovereign. When Putin attacks Lenin, it is the real person with his real ideas, convictions, and policies that he attacks. But when the occupying Russian army re-erects statues of Lenin, it is the sovereign figure that they reinstall. This sovereign figure has little to do with the real person. It has been long emptied of Lenin's ideas and communist goals and values. Nor does it have anything to do with the resurrection of the Soviet Union. Reinstalling statues of Lenin is an act of claiming sovereign power of Putin's Russian world over occupied Ukrainian territories, but without claiming a return to the Soviet Union. It is telling that the invading army does not create new statues of Lenin. Instead, soldiers look for the statues that stood in these places before. In the town of Genichesk, which is this picture here, near Kherson, Russian soldiers reassembled Lenin from broken pieces that had been lying in an abandoned warehouse, cemented them back together, and painted the statue to conceal the seams. The reassembled statue represents the resurrected sovereign figure that is emptied of the Soviet project and emptied of all communist ideology. Now it indexes an anti-Soviet and anti-Leninist empire. This idea, so this Lenin is anti-Lenin. This idea was recently articulated in a pro-Russian newspaper, separatist newspaper in Donbass. Quote, reinstalling statues of Lenin has nothing to do with with communism and everything to do with the memories of a country that was once united and strong, and with the warning to everyone that this country will inevitably rise again. It was the doubling of Lenin's obras that goes back to the beginning of Soviet history that allows for this imperialist fantasy to exist and to be wrapped in this peculiar paradox of blaming Lenin as the worst enemy of the imperial Russian project and at the same time resurrecting statues of Lenin as a claim of continuous and uninterrupted sovereignty of that imperialist project. Thank you. Okay.